Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron explore a few areas that you will be better off addressing at the beginning of the year. You can make all of your traditional and Roth IRA contributions in January to benefit from compound growth sooner. You might even increase your 401k contributions around this time to maximize your annual benefit. Further, January is a great month to increase your savings rate by 1% to help your future self. Aaron then discusses many substantial benefits of exercising incentive stock options in January. There's no penalty for missing some of these, but life is just a little easier if you take action now. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. Now that we're into the new year, into 2021, kind of holidays are past, kids are back at school. Well, I mean, I'm going to borrow Trishul's joke, back at school in air quotes, whatever it looks like, depending on where you live. For me, it's still distance learning. So back, kids are back at the dining room table on Google Classroom, but like we're kind of getting back into normal life, normal routine. And we want to take some time to think about some of the things that we focus on at the beginning of the year that just make a little bit more sense to do now, at least take a look at or consider rather than pushing it off. This is not things like end of year reviews. That's what we do professionally, kind of talk, have conversations with clients, but this is more some actions that might make your life just a little easier if you do it sooner rather than later. And it just makes things a little smoother by doing it in January. So, Trishul, at the beginning of each year, when you're back to work post-holidays, what are some of the early things that you look at?
Top of mind, something that I kind of think about around this time is just kind of maxing out that IRA contribution. And the reason that comes to mind is it's the notion that you have these limits of in 2020, it's like 6,000 per working or per earned income earner. If your wife is earning and your husband is earning 6,000, more than 6,000, then you can contribute a total of 12.
It's 6,500 in 2020 and 2021. So now it's 13,000 combined. Right. Oh, sorry. Did I add the catch-up contribution to that? I think I was looking at catch-up contributions.
Yeah, the number I have is for 2020 is 6,000.
Okay, sorry. I derailed you with incorrect information. I apologize.
All good. But yeah, so what you want to do is, or what you want to think about at least, is often as financial planners, we kind of say you don't want to time the market and you want to kind of dollar cost average into things, meaning if you're getting a certain amount of income and you want to allocate it towards, you know, retirement, maybe you want to put, you know, like $100 a month or a few hundred dollars a month each month. And then over time, you'll not be timing the markets, but you'll be able to progressively dollar cost average. And it's a sensible strategy. However, this is one case where timing is a little bit more important because you actually have the opportunity to invest that entire 6,000 if you happen to have that capital at hand all at once at the beginning of the year. And the reason I say that is on average, the markets do go up. So it's helpful to get that money invested sooner rather than later, especially in a tax shelter like a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA, where the longer it's in there, the better it's going to be for you because you get that effect of compounding on a tax deferred basis for a longer period of time. And it seems like, you know, just kind of like a small issue, but it can help over long periods just by making this one shift of something that you're probably going to do anyway. So to kind of just put a little bit of numbers behind it to just show how much of an impact something like this can have. There's some data that was, you know, just put forward by Betterment. They just ran the calculations on this and they compared two scenarios. One is if you put that, you know, let's say $6,000 to work immediately in January. And the other is if you kind of wait till the end of the year to make that same payment. And the notion is some people just kind of forget and they're like, oh, quick, I got to make that payment. So they end up being late. They end up, you know, doing it in December or even a few months later, even after that. In fact, you have until tax time of the following year to make that payment, April 15th. But if you're proactive and you do it way when you're first allowed to in January, for example, if you do it now for 2021, well, you get this extra benefit of compounding for the entire year. And looking at this, for example, over 10 years, assuming they assumed a 10% return, which I think is a little fluffy, but you know, just kind of going with that, it just shows that over this period, you end up with about just 14% more money at the end of the period. So, you know, that's kind of the difference between ending up with 100,000 and 114,000. And, you know, for making a small change like that on something you're likely to do anyway, it's not a bad thing to do.
That actually reminds me of the 401k contributions from a similar perspective, where as you're making contributions throughout the year from your salary to a 401k, technically you don't have to make those even contributions. You can spread out these over throughout the year, and actually you can make kind of lumpy contributions. You can change it, do some early, some late, and kind of make sure that you get that contribution at the end of the year. If you need to, you can just withhold more of your salary to that. But most clients, almost from the opposite perspective, find evening it out throughout the year provides a little more stability with their take-home pay on their paycheck, and it's easier to do some more cash flow planning. Also, as contribution limits go up, they aren't going up from 20 to 21. They're both staying at 19,500. And if you're over 50, you can do another 6,500 catch-up contribution. And they're staying the same from 2020 to 2021. But it is something we look at each year, where maybe your 11% contribution last year was enough to max it out, but same 11% contribution this year might actually come a little short. And so instead of having to kind of check at the end of the year, did we max it out? We can actually do the math now at the beginning of the year, say, oh no, this year we need to bump that up to a 12% contribution. And there's a couple of factors here. One is just making sure we're on track to contribute that maximum for that year. And that's the simple thing of anytime we can max out the 401k, that's a really, really good default advice. And I recommend it to everyone. If you have the income, try, and you're working at a company that has a 401k, try and max that out every year. Two, this is another time where this is the opportunity to make those 1% increments that really make a big difference over years and decades. So even if you're already maxing out your 401k, having the conversation and planning, how can I increase my savings by 1% this year, where you're not going to notice any difference in kind of in your lifestyle. But if you do that, where you increase your saving 1% this year and increase saving at 1% the next year, and just like the compounding of actual rate of return, the compounding of savings really adds up over time. So this is the time of year where just double checking the contribution. And so if you were only doing 7%, increase to 8%, and you won't even notice it, but making sure that you are on track to max it out. And if you already are, how else can you increase your savings by 1%? And it's the combination of just using the 401k as the context of of doing that kind of analysis of how much am I saving? And maybe if you got a raise and your income is higher, that you're already, you're kind of limited by the, maxing out the 401k, and it's actually your savings rate went down. So because the 401k contribution limit stayed the same, if your income went up and you were maxing out last year, that implies just your 401k savings is actually now a lower percentage of your salary, is a lower percentage of your income. Then you need to maintain that savings rate somewhere else. And January is usually a great time to implement that. Again, you could do it anytime you wanted, but everything works out just a little easier, a little smoother if we really look at what is your savings rate, what is 401k contribution, what's the IRA contribution if you wanted to do that, but focusing on that savings rate for the next year. And January is always the best time to take a look at that.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. I like the fact that the 401k gets a priority in your calculus and your hierarchy. It makes sense to me also because there's a chance you might get an employee match in there as well. And by maxing that out, that also opens the opportunity, if you're going to be investing more, to consider probably your next tax shelter in line. Now, likely if you're above the income limit for the contribution for a traditional IRA, you might be considering doing, or for a Roth IRA, that is, you might be considering that backdoor Roth. So that's something that you can kind of go ahead and set up all the way in January if you're pretty sure you're going to be over those income limits to contribute to the Roth. And that would just mean, again, you're setting up to max out your 401k, so you might be doing a non-deductible contribution to your traditional IRA and then doing that conversion to your Roth so that you can get those funds where they need to be sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and just kind of a little bit of math behind that. If you make over 139 as a single filer in terms of modified adjusted gross income, or 206,000 for joint, that was the 2020 numbers, then you're ineligible to contribute to a Roth. You'll have to do the backdoor. But if you have incomes on that scale and you're able to max out your 401k, so that 19,500, if that's going to be a, say, 10% savings rate, that implies a income of 195. And so if your maxed out 401k is a 12% savings rate, then that would be an income of, on a scale of 162, 163. And so it's a combination of what's your expected income for the year, both single household relative to filing status, making that 401k contribution. And as your income goes up, where maxing out the 401k is a savings rate below 10, which from a financial planning perspective is probably too low. We really like those higher savings rates. Even go back to our first episode, I love a 401k saving, like, or retirement savings on the scale of 12 to 15%. You might be a little more aggressive and want that much, much higher savings rate. But if you're at an income where maxing out the 401k does not meet that savings rate target, you're also likely in a situation where you can't do a direct Roth IRA contribution. You'll probably have to do a backdoor. And so you need to actually plan this out. I think that's my general point, is that if you make, say, under that 140 number, 139, contributing to your 401k, doing the Roth, it kind of focus on your savings rate and you'll probably be in great position. If you can contribute 15% of your salary to 401k and or Roth IRA, you're in great shape, and just keep doing that. It's when incomes start getting a little higher and you start bumping into those limits and you need to maintain the savings rate that planning becomes more important.
Yeah. And just in case you missed your 2020 contributions to your IRAs, as I mentioned, you still have time, even though it's January 1st. You can still make those until April 15th.
Yes. And so it's always been the case for IRAs. So you can make the prior year IRA contribution up until April 15th and when you file your taxes. And I believe this year they've made a change for 401ks. Do you know more about that?
Yeah. So there is also some flexibility. For example, with the solo 401k, this kind of comes up when you have a small business and you want to have some sort of 401k-like plan and you don't have any employees. So this would just be for a sole proprietorship or a small business with one person. But there's also the ability for the spouse to participate in this type of plan. But either way, so previously the deadlines for the employee contribution, that 19.5, used to be around tax time. I mean, sorry, end of year. And then the employer had some time to make that separate contribution. Now, also, one other thing was that plan had to be set up if this was your first year setting up this plan by December 31st. In this case, December 31st, 2020, so that these contributions could be made. Well, there is some flexibility this year in particular, just because of COVID, where all of these deadlines are pushed back to tax time, meaning if you have not even set up this type of plan, an individual 401k, you can set it up until tax time and you can fund it from the employee's perspective at 19.5, and then from the employer's perspective. Now, the employer itself can kind of match that amount up, but it's also limited by the amount of income generated by the actual business. And that gets a little complicated, but, you know, like a ballpark is maybe 20% of that income could be added in addition to that 19.5K to the employee's contribution from the employer.
Yeah. Okay. So when it comes to retirement plans, anything else that you can think of, whether it's IRAs, 401ks, small business retirement plans, that focusing on now in January makes sense?
Well, those are the big ones, but there may be some things to think about when you're thinking about like stock options. So Aaron, do you have some things there that might make sense?
Yes. So this is one thing that comes up with incentive stock options. So ISOs, if you've listened to the past conversation with incentive stock options, if you exercise and hold for 12 months, for 1 year, and this is 2 years from grant date. So 1 year from exercise and 2 years from grant date before you sell your shares, then the entire amount from strike price, which is your exercise price, to your sales price is taxed at long-term capital gains. If you don't satisfy those holding requirements, so again, 2 years from grant date, 1 year from exercise, then the bargain elements, the spread, which is the difference between strike price and fair market value at time of exercise, is taxed at ordinary income rates. So ISOs convert back to being non-qualified stock options or non-statutory stock options. So if clients have ISOs, scheduling out the ISO exercise becomes very important. And there's AMT issues. There is just, you have to pay the cash to exercise the options because you aren't going to do a cashless exercise. You aren't going to immediately sell. So you have to come up with the cash for the exercise. You have to consider if there's going to be AMT or tax issues. And you're planning on holding these for a year. So you won't have the proceeds from the ISO exercise until the following year. With publicly traded companies, so the companies that you could sell the stock if you wanted to, exercising ISOs in January tends to be the better systematic strategy because you're giving yourself more time in the same calendar year to see what the stock does and what your other income does. So for example, if you were to exercise your ISOs in January, you wait 11 months, so it's December, based on your other income, AMT issues, the change in the stock price, you can choose to sell the stock in December. This would not qualify for the ISO rules, for the ISO benefits of getting long-term capital gains. This is called a disqualifying disposition. You're intentionally giving up the ISO benefit, and you will be increasing your ordinary income. So now the original exercise is, and all the way up to the sales price, would be taxed as ordinary income. It's actually the strike price to fair market value at exercise is ordinary income. The exercise to sales price is short-term capital gains. It's the same rate, but sometimes it can make a difference in tax filings. But for all intents and purposes, it's all ordinary income. This can increase your regular tax calculation, which might actually get you out of AMT. Your tax rate might be higher and you might not be in AMT, but you've given yourself the flexibility to actually take advantage or take action in December. Whereas if you exercise later in the year, you don't have as much time to see what happens. And you're still planning on holding 12 months anyways, and it's going to push more of that stock volatility into the following year. So exercising in January gives you the flexibility to see what happens with the stock and the rest of your income, and the choice to create a disqualifying disposition in December. The other big benefit of exercising ISOs in January is you don't have to withhold on the exercise price. So with NSOs and things like RSUs, the withholding occurs at vesting. With NSOs, the withholding occurs at exercise. With ISOs, there's no withholding. It's just based on sale proceeds when you eventually sell. So if everything goes smoothly and we do exercise January 2021, planning on holding these ISO shares until January 2022, we do know we're going to have a tax bill come spring of 2022 based on our actions January 2021. But now we've satisfied that 12-month holding period where we can sell those ISO shares, get the long-term capital gains benefits. It'll actually go on to your 2022 taxes because that's when you realize the income. But if there was, an AMT bill based on the January 2021 exercise, you now have the proceeds to pay that AMT bill spring of 2022 when you file your 2021 taxes. So exercising ISOs in January, you get both the benefit of seeing what happens with the stock price and the rest of your income and other exercise strategies. You get more time, but also the following year when you have to pay the taxes associated with that exercise, you now have proceeds to pay those taxes. And then if you have more ISOs and you have a strategy that you're implementing, you could even then have more proceeds to exercise your next tranche of ISOs. And you get into this kind of system of exercising and selling ISO shares every January, where you exercise one, wait a year, sell one, use those proceeds to exercise two, following year, sell two, use those proceeds to exercise three. And you kind of keep pushing this out over years. It also, from a financial planning perspective, helps with concentration risk, where now your ISOs that are unexercised can kind of represent a large enough percentage of your overall net worth. You're selling the ISO shares, you're getting all the long-term capital gains benefits because you held it for 12 months, but you're selling those shares to pay for the exercise of the shares in the same company. And so it's a way to kind of take care of the taxes, get the long-term capital gain benefit, and use the money from selling your company stock to exercise options in your company stock. You don't have to sell outside assets. You don't have to either take money from your taxable investments or from your cash positions to exercise that next tranche of ISOs. And it's this kind of confluence of three or four different benefits that make exercising ISOs in January for a publicly traded company usually ideal. So I know this is kind of complex, and it's anytime you have ISOs, you want to talk to a financial advisor, but this system of planning on exercising ISOs in January really tends to make a lot of the tax decisions, the exercise costs, the stock volatility, you give yourself more time, more information, and you take advantage of this very short 2 to 3 month window between when you sell the stock in our example in January 2022 to pay the actual tax bill that's owed for your 2021 taxes, because you don't file until March or April. I mean, you could get an extension, but you have to pay the taxes then anyways. Even if you get an extension, you have to pay up front. So it's generating the cash proceeds, still getting long-term capital gains benefits, and still getting in before you have to pay your taxes for 2021 anyways. So I know that's a lot. Did you follow all that, Tricia? Do you have any questions on some of those details that I tried to lay out?
Good stuff, Aaron. I like how all of that kind of links up to come up with a cohesive strategy. And I think two things came to my mind. One is, it seems like January might also give the opportunity to make a decision in December if the actual position is down, meaning would that open up the opportunity to have a short-term capital loss rather than waiting till January to have a long-term capital loss, which wouldn't be as favorable?
I want to say, again, I'll have to double check, and even for the CPA, I think you would get a capital loss, but your ordinary income would be higher anyways. You'd just be paying taxes on the difference from strike price to sales price. Like you get the income, but then you have the short-term capital gains that immediately offsets it. What you're really doing is, if the stock price is down, then you realize you're not paying AMT on the higher stock price when you exercised. That's the big benefit, that you're choosing to, and it gets pretty complex because you want to try and account for a potential AMT credit in following years. But you can actually do the math of, would I rather pay ordinary income on the current sales price and considering your basis, so all ordinary income plus short-term capital gains at the lower price, or AMT at the higher price, getting long-term capital gains the following year, and then potentially an AMT credit. And they're complex calculations, and you want to talk to a CPA or a financial advisor to do the math, but it is a realistic possibility that you'd actually rather pay ordinary income rates on the lower amount than long-term capital gains on the higher amount. and then AMT is mixed in there as well. So that, right. that's kind of how it would play out. So it's not necessarily the capital loss per se. It's ordinary income rates on a lower amount versus long-term capital gains and or AMT on a higher amount.
And, you know, the good news is sometimes after that calculation, it can be a pretty easy decision.
Yeah, yeah. And so you've given yourself time to actually do that calculation.
Right. Well, the other thing I wanted to key in on is, so if it's a private company, how do you see that changing the calculus?
So if it's a private company, the idea is that you have ISOs, but you can't, even if you exercise the ISOs, you can't sell the shares.
Right.
And so if you exercise ISOs, under regular taxes, you don't owe any taxes. On the regular calculation, you don't owe any taxes until you sell. It's only under AMT. And so it's that ISO exercise is an AMT preference item either way. For private companies, it's not as easy, but if we're going to exercise without selling, it might make more sense to do it at the end of the year, where under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, there's which kind of raised a lot of the AMT numbers, it's now possible to exercise some ISOs without going into AMT at the end of the year. That's one thing that you can look for. But you kind of need as much information about what your income was for the year to be able to make that calculation. And at the beginning of the year, you don't know or have enough certainty on what your income was for the year. So that's one reason why for private companies, I tend to wait until December to do ISO exercise. Also, it's a very realistic possibility with a private company that it just makes sense to wait until there's some liquidity event that you, if you're with ISOs, if you have an AMT tax bill and it's a private company, there's no guarantee that the company is going to go public or that there's going to be a liquidity event. So while the strike price might be low and it might not cost that much out of pocket for the exercise, it might cost a lot in terms of taxes. And so sometimes, depending on other factors, including how likely you'll be there working for the foreseeable future and for several years into the future, it might make just sense just to not exercise the ISOs. Let's just wait to see what happens. And it's a really big balancing act of trying to make the best tax decision versus the investment risk. And so the investment risk with ISOs isn't necessarily from the exercise price, it's the AMT tax bill on the spread. So if it's really early in the company and the company is not worth very much and your options are very cheap, you might be able to exercise them then. The spread's going to be very small, and so there's very little AMT concern. But the odds that this company pays off are so low, you really have to be willing to lose this money. Like, literally, you could lose everything that you put into these ISOs. If you're waiting until the company has grown and there's a greater probability that it will pay off, we've also seen that spread increase and AMT becomes a bigger concern. So there's a lot of other factors, but very roughly, with considering an ISO exercise for a private company, probably waiting until the end of the year when we have more information regarding your income for that taxable year. We know what your salary was, what your bonuses were, what other investment decisions you made that may have generated capital gains or capital losses. Like, you just have more information. And so you can make that calculation a little bit better.
Right. Yeah, that does make sense. And as you said, that it might even be for that private company that you choose not to exercise. You keep that optionality by saying that, you know, you might have another 8 years before you need to exercise, given that's a private company and you can't liquidate it. that might provide you with a tangible benefit of not having to, you know, lock up your funds for that period of time where you might not be able to get it out.
Exactly. And so that's it's kind of when the taxes are low and easy, the investment risk is the highest. When the investment risk gets lower, but it's still not gone, even companies that get into the third, fourth, fifth round of funding, and they'll have like their 409A valuation, like the trying to apply a value to the stock, could look pretty good. It could still not end up paying out. They could still get bought out in a way that doesn't actually pay out shareholders. Like there's a variety of ways that it doesn't pay out, and the risk is still pretty high. You need to be much, much closer to an IPO or liquidity event. And at that point, the company is worth enough that you have the confidence it'll pay off, but the AMT bill is also going to be really high. And so you need to have cash to be ready to pay that AMT bill. So kind of almost the perfect time to exercise ISOs is 6 months before the IPO date. And assuming you've held the ISOs for a year already. And the reason I say that is that if you can line up the exercise of ISOs with when the standard 6 month lockup ends, and so you can exercise ISOs, hold for 1 year and sell them, that's as close to ideal as you can get, but you don't know 6 months in advance when the IPO date's going to be and what the lockup's going to be. And if you do, you're probably subject to a lot more restrictions, whether it comes to insider trading, when it comes to sales strategy. You're a high enough executive that there's so many other rules that'll be restricting you, and you could have different lockups, you could have holding requirements. So that's a whole different can of worms. Kind of, if you know when the IPO is going to happen, then you need a different exercise and sales strategy. But if you can sell after the 6 month lockup and you can guess when the IPO is, then 6 months before the IPO is an ideal time to exercise ISOs, but that's just a lot of guessing. And no, it's one of those things, no one actually gets it right. Some people guess and they get lucky, but no one's able to plan consistently enough.
I like how the way our tax system is structured, that we have to kind of be magicians and trying to extrapolate and make these types of decisions.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily trying to do that, because a lot of the tax decisions are kind of, they're almost designed to reward risk. And we've talked about this kind of in the past, of like the risk associated with ownership and how a lot of preferred tax rates are for owners and stockholders rather than income earners. And so if you wanted the security, you can just pay the higher tax rate. So with ISOs, you don't have to exercise advance. You don't even have to hold them for 12 months. You could do, again, what's that disqualifying disposition. Once the IPO happens, you wait for the lockup to end and you just sell everything. And you're going to have it all taxes on your income. You've taken no investment risk. You never put any of your own money at risk. You just have a really, really high tax bill. But the ISO or IRS kind of provides that incentive. There's a tax incentive to take on the investment risk. And so if you are willing to take on that investment risk, then you get rewarded in terms of tax rates and long-term capital gains. So kind of, that's why I say it's not a perverse incentive, but it's kind of a very direct, you don't have to take on that investment risk. You're just going to have a really high tax bill. And so for some people, that's what they prefer, that they don't like the idea of putting money at risk, and they're okay paying that really high tax bill. For some people, and for most people, it's some combination. It's going to be some ISOs get exercised and held, some ISOs get exercised and immediately sold, disqualifying disposition. There's, for the vast majority of clients, there's some gray area in the middle that makes the most sense for them. That we're going to exercise and sell some of your shares, take on kind of eliminate the investment risk, but pay a higher tax bill. Not as high a tax bill as if we sold everything, but we'll have enough proceeds to cover the taxes for the shares that we exercised and held, that we're going to try and get long-term capital gains rates down the road. And that's one of the calculations I do for clients is, here are kind of five different strategies we could do of exercising and selling, exercising and holding different numbers of shares over the next few years based on vesting schedule, et cetera. And over this five-year time frame, what has our lowest tax bill? And are you comfortable with that investment risk? Okay, not quite comfortable with that investment risk. Here's the next level up of, we've reduced some of the investment risk, but our taxes go up by this much. Are you okay paying that slightly higher tax bill?
I like the way you kind of say that. That does put it into a little bit of better perspective in my mind, because I remember being an employee and having to make these decisions on, you know, do I exercise or not, and do I pay them out or not? And then I'm kind of thinking as an employee, okay, now I'm modeling my perception on how I think the business is going to perform in terms of, is it going to go public and is it going to provide some sort of cash out? And then I'm doing all of these probability calculations, or, you know, just trying to figure out some sense of all this. But in my mind, I feel like, why am I doing all of this as an employee? But, you know, the way you say it does kind of make sense. The government is trying to incentivize people to be rewarded for taking that longer term risk of putting their money to work in a business.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you remember kind of what you did at the time?
Well, but those were non-qualified stock options. Okay. So it was a different story, but there was the concern about if it's a private company and, you know, do we want to exercise or not? And that's something that went through our mind.
Okay. Yeah. With private company. Yeah. It's kind of, are you willing to put the money at risk? Because it's not just the exercise price. You'll have to pay the taxes when you exercise. And so how much money are you putting at risk versus what's the upside? There's definitely still that same calculus of investment versus taxes, but it's a little more straightforward with non-qualified stock options. With ISOs, it definitely gets more complex, but the rewards are potentially greater.
Yeah. I remember the decision kind of came down to, do we feel like we want to take that tax bill? That was the biggest hit that we were concerned about.
Yeah. And one of those kind of benefits of ISOs is the employee gets the choice of keeping them as ISOs or treating them as NSOs. Like they can exercise and sell and they get that choice and that control. You can't go the other way. You can't get granted NSOs and then try to get them treated as ISOs. So that is one of those small things about ISOs that is a nice extra benefit, is you have, at least you have a choice. You have some flexibility.
But I believe there's also a limit on how much you can be granted with the ISOs. Is it 100K, something like that?
You can only have 100K worth of the strike price vest each year. And right. The company granting them will kind of take care of that. And depending on the company, having 100K of the strike price doesn't seem to be an issue that comes up that often. For some clients, basically the company just, we're going to reward you 40,000 options, but 28,000 are going to be ISOs because we can see what your vesting schedule is going to look like 2 years from now, and 12,000 to be NSOs. So they will just kind of break those up, and they do a pretty good job of that. And yeah, it does come into play, but it's rarely something the clients have to worry about. It's just they get this many ISOs and this many NSOs. So that's more of a company restriction. It does come in. It's something to kind of that advisors should know about just to keep an eye out. But most companies that are putting in the stock plans and granting ISOs to their employees are taking care of that for them.
Good stuff.
Okay. That I think I went longer on ISO exercise than I intended to. So I hope you appreciated it.
All good. Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, there's a handful of topics that we see from time to time where these types of decisions can make a pretty large impact on your outcome. So this is certainly one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you very much, Trishul. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed it as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And of course, if you're enjoying these episodes, do subscribe to our podcast. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.